Okay, welcome back, everybody. I hope you enjoyed your lunch. So the next session is something I'm really excited about, actually. This is the Advocacy at the Intersection project, which is a partnership between Queer Space and Daru. And I'll just read the blurb and then I'll let the others do the rest of it. Accessibility and inclusion is more than just a checklist. Our interactive workshop will reflect on 6 months of the Daru and Queer Space Advocacy at the Intersection project and provide an opportunity for the disability advocacy sector to discuss what advocating for LGBTIQ plus inclusion looks like. We'll share training videos and tip sheets co-designed by LGBTIQ plus people with disabilities and disability advocacy organisations, aiming to highlight best practice examples and value of sharing lived experience. So it's my pleasure to introduce Jackie Brown and Jess Mata from Queer Space, and also later on Damien Kavanagh from Daru. Thank you.
Thank you for that introduction.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me? Cool.
Wonderful. So before we begin, I'd like to pay my respects to the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations on which land we're meeting today. I'd like to extend my respects to any Indigenous members that we have in this room. Always was, always will be Indigenous land. I'd also like to pay my respects to the Wurundjeri and the Bunurong people, in which all the resources and materials for the project was developed on their land.
So my name's Jax, my pronouns are they and she, and I'm working on this project with Jess. I really like watching serious documentaries, going to the playground and playing with my kid, and I'm a terrible gardener.
Hello everyone, I'm Jess. I use they, them and she, her pronouns, please. And a little fun fact about me, which I don't think I've told Jax yet, but a couple of days ago, my partner proposed to me.
Oh, wow! For your wedding! Yay! Congratulations. Cool.
So, a quick tip on safety. As we're all aware, being advocates or people with lived experience or both in the disability sector, we understand that language is very important, and how we use language to describe our own identities and how we use language to describe other people is very crucial and very personal. I would also like you to reflect on how important that is to use similar language and that same type of thought and respect when we're talking about the LGBTQIA plus community.
So in today's workshop, we only have an hour. So we really want to start to think about what the project is, where we're headed with it, what outcomes we're hoping to achieve by June 2020, give you a bit of an understanding of language and the language used in the LGBTIQ plus acronym, what all those letters mean, who they might refer to, and how you might use them. We're going to look at the terms of sex, gender and sexuality and talk you through the difference in those terms and what they mean. We have some scenarios that we're going to get you to do at your tables in groups later on. And we're really keen to get your feedback and thoughts about those, because we're going to use them when we build our online 2-hour training module for the disability advocacy sector in LGBTIQ plus inclusion. So you guys are kind of our first group of people that we really want to get robust and honest feedback about how you find today and what you want to include. Yes, good, Greg.
Thank you.
So first we're going to look briefly at an overview of the project, who was involved and what we plan to do between now and June when our little grant, which is through the Office for Disability, ends. So our project aims to provide advocacy training and experiences on the needs of LGBTIQ people with disabilities to the disability advocacy sector. So we're going to do our online training, as I just said, which will roll out hopefully next month. But we're also going to be doing a face-to-face training at the VCOS offices on Tuesday, the 11th of May, which will go for 2 hours as well. So if you log into the online module and you think, wow, I'd love some face-to-face training as kind of a follow-on from today, we really encourage you to come along to share it with your networks and to bring your colleagues too. We really want to acknowledge the work of Daru and thank you so much for inviting us to be here today and being our project partner. We're really excited about this partnership. And we also want to welcome Jade from WIDAS, who's on our co-design team. And she's going to come up and speak later about that experience as well.
So who are we? For those of you who have not heard of Queer Space is located within the Drummond Street services, predominantly at 100 Drummond Street in Carlton. Queer Space is a fantastic leading organisation in the field of LGBTQIA plus rights. They provide not only resources and information, but amazing therapeutic and lived experience positions within their organisation as well.
And they have a really keen and ongoing interest in having someone or multiple people with disabilities working for them. So this is the first of many projects that we hope to partner with different organisations in.
But who best to talk about Daru? Damien! Can we welcome Damien up, please?
Got the lectern, I don't know. Which one? This one works, right. Thank you, Jess and Jax. So being a part of this project, or any project really, is having a good partner, and we're certainly, Daru has been very lucky and fortunate to have Jax and Jess lead and progress this project with us. Daru's role is to produce the online learning module and training materials for the disability sector. And for us, the co-design process we've been through today, it's been invaluable. The terms and concepts like intersectionality, which Jack and Jess will talk about more today, do not come across to some people regularly, the people we will be training and using the module regularly. So we can give textbook definitions and Wikipedia links and things like that, but it doesn't really come alive until it's relevant and relatable to a person's place in their work. And the co-design process has really enabled that to get the stories, the quotes and the scenarios from people with the lived experience. We hope you enjoy and be involved in some of those scenarios later on. Working together with Queer Space meant that we have the benefit of the rich expertise and lived experience of people with a disability who identified as LGBTIQ+. And we're able to hear from people themselves without about what's the most important factors we need to consider to ensure the training really has the voice of people with disabilities identify as LGBTQI+. And we've been able to pull our excellent resources together with videos and online and tip sheets to all credit hopefully a really good targeted learning package. And without we'd better do it without working with Queer Space. So it is a credit to the co-designer group and Queer Space to get that we've been able to get the best out of the group in a respectful way. I've been involved in projects that are more faux design than co-design, but this one I hope we are well on our way to producing something that is has the lived experience voice and is relatable and relevant to the disability advocacy sector.
Thank you.
So I just thought I'd tell you briefly about the co-design process. So it has 5 representatives from disability advocacy organisations, including Women with Disabilities Victoria, the Youth Disability Advocacy Service, Leadership Plus, Melbourne East Disability Advocacy, and Grampians Disability Advocacy. So we were really looking to get a wide variety of experiences. We really wanted rural perspectives of what it's like to work in advocacy in the country as well. We also have 3 representatives who come from the LGBTI communities or work in LGBTI organisations, and 3 people who have lived experience, so who are both disabled and LGBTIQ. So that's been really important in terms of being able to have a wide variety of perspectives and experiences, both professionally and personally, that help us shape the project and help us think about what is important, what do we need to include, what learnings is the disability advocacy sector really looking for in the LGBTIQ space. Next up, we'd like to welcome Jade from YDAS to talk briefly about what her experience has been being part of our co-design group and any other comments she wants to make in terms of what she may think is important for the advocacy sector to know about being LGBTIQ inclusive.
Let's welcome Jade, everyone.
Hi. Thanks for having me. It's been very nice working with everyone on this project. For what it's been like to be part of the co-design group, it has been very good and empowering, and I like being able to give my opinion and feel like it's being heard and used for something meaningful. I did come through as a representative from a disability advocacy organisation, but also being a queer disabled woman, working within that sector made it feel like it was a job that I didn't really realise I'd studied my whole life for. So it's been very good working on it and nice doing so. As for what I think is important for advocacy services to know to be LGBTIQ plus inclusive, I think it's important to note that there's a higher than average correlation between the two groups, and it's working towards being more inclusive isn't just helping one in a million people, even though if it was, it'd still be just as important, I believe. But it's more like one in 10 or even more, as there is a higher correlation between the two groups. And there's a few stats around that say that in queer groups, there are about a third of the people within those groups have a disability. Mm-hmm. I think it's also important to note the intersectional beliefs, and that people within that intersection receive reduced support and social connection from both groups, thus leaving them more isolated and vulnerable. Practically speaking, what I think is important for advocacy organisations to know is that it can working towards being more inclusive can be quite simple and start off that way, and it can also be quite in depth, and it's really what you have the capacity to do. So practically speaking, a small example could be that you could begin with something quite small, like having your pronouns listed in your email signatures, because this can just be a simple indicator that shows that you're welcoming to people and open to having conversations and it being acceptive. An example of something that would be important for people who work with clients, individual advocates in particular, would be knowing what laws and guidelines apply to people from that intersection, and also knowing how and when to speak up when you think they are being discriminated against. Mm-hmm. And I think as organisations, I think it's important that there's creation of dialogue between disability advocacy organisations and LGBTIQ plus advocacy organisations, so they can communicate and collaborate on issues that affect both populations and can work together.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. So we spoke a little bit about the project outcomes, and I'll go over this quite briefly and a little bit more in depth. So our co-design team, we definitely have put them to work. We are in the process of developing 5 short videos. One of those videos you'll be watching here today at the end of the session, and that is on LGBTQA plus 101. So hopefully you'll have some learning you'll be able to get from that. Something that's a little bit more tailored towards the LGBT organisations and communities. So we have Accessibility 101. The next video that we developed is a conversation between both groups talking about loneliness, isolation and community. And then we take those learnings and we have a video on how we can work together and how we can advocate together for change. We'll have tip sheets developed alongside. One of those tip sheets should be on your tables. It is a draft version. It is the LGBTQA plus 101 tip sheet. And as Jax mentioned before, we have a 4-hour training package in person and a 2-hour online training package. So I briefly had a conversation with you all about language this morning, and unfortunately we can't spend the whole hour going into language and the importance, but I would like you to take a moment and just have some reflection on what language or terms do you or we use to describe ourselves? Why do we use this language or terms we choose to use? And do we use different language or terms at different times? So if you're taking one reflective moment from today, I would hope you ponder on those. So time for a crash course. So we're going to have a conversation about the difference of sex, sexuality, and gender. I would just like to reiterate that this is a safe place. It is okay to get things wrong. It is okay to get things a little bit confused. You do all have a cheat sheet on your table, so feel free to look at that as well. And please ask questions. So I'm going to try to orchestrate this a little bit more of a workshop. So your participation is crucial. For those people who would like to speak, either vocalise, put your hand up, or indicate how you feel comfortable. So how do we define sex? What is some biological ways that we, as a society, define sex? Yes, oh sorry, we might need a microphone runner. Sorry, Melissa.
Who you're attracted to is a start.
Definitely. So who we are attracted to is definitely how we enact our sexuality. But when you're born and the doctor pulls you out, what's the first thing they do?
I was just going to say, they look at your genitals and or your hormones.
Yeah, definitely. So genitals and hormones, chromosomes, those are definitely ways we define sex in society. But curious question, I don't think any of you can see my junk or my genitals, and I'll be a little bit worried if you can. So there must be other ways we define sex, and I don't know about you, I've never gotten my chromosomes checked either. So what are some legal documents that define our sex?
Your birth certificate?
Yeah, definitely. So your birth certificate has defines it. What's on your passport? Yeah, so we have got some cardinal documents that we use nearly every day with service providers, especially where we're starting up a new connection with them. And what are some structural ways we define sex? This might be a little bit harder to answer. So things you might be doing accidental, intentionally, or otherwise in your organizations.
Uh, I was going to say, like, the bathrooms. Like,
yes.
Having, like, defined bathrooms, like male, female, not having inclusive bathrooms, and then maybe not talking about people's pronouns, just assuming.
Definitely. So we're definitely going to spaces of gender with the pronouns. We'll come back to that in a moment. But maybe sometimes you have induction forms or intake forms, and on those forms you might only have the boxes male and female. So we all know what it feels like when someone uses a label on us, when that label doesn't, it's not a term that we identify with, and how uncomfortable that label can feel. Fun fact, in the human population, there are already over 20 known sex variations. So it gets a little bit limiting if we're only limiting ourselves to male and female. The intersex community, roughly around 2% of the population, where a lot of people who are intersex are often don't know that they're intersex until they've either hit puberty, are they choosing to try to conceive a child, or it might be have some complications at birth as well. The Intersex Human Rights Australia has a beautiful definition of intersex and best practices as well. So that's definitely something to take into consideration. Sexuality. What's some examples? I'll start straight.
Or heterosexual.
Heterosexual, yeah. What are some other examples of sexuality?
Gay.
Yeah, gay, homosexual. Woo woo.
Queer.
Queer. Bisexual, lesbian. Yes, so that is a term that is quite often used as a derogative way that we try to avoid, but that is a way that some people not within the community sometimes try to define us, and going back to labels that we don't like. But when we're starting at a place of trying to understand sexuality, and this is a good way to take a moment to kind of reflect on your own sexuality, because quite a lot of people don't get that opportunity, is to try to think of it in terms of a sexual trichotomy. So our sexual identity, starting at the very top of the triangle, our sexual identity is how we identify. So you could publicly and internally have two different identifications. So internally you might be like, I am a gay man, but publicly I tell people I'm straight, for example. And that's a personal choice, and that's a very private choice. I'm going to assume quite a few people in this room probably, without even realizing, identify as heterosexual or straight. You may have never been asked that in the first place. Our sexual orientation, looking at my notes, sorry, is referred to who we are attracted to. So bringing it back to the point at the very start. So you could be sitting in this room and be like, you know, I might identify as a straight male, and my sexual orientation means I'm attracted to women. Doesn't mean I'm attracted to every single woman ever, but it just means that's where my sexual orientation predominantly lies. And our sexual behavior is how we enact that. So for example, if you are a married man who is straight, so you are identifying as straight, your sexual orientation is, yes, I'm attracted to women, and my behavior, because I'm in a monogamous relationship, I choose not to enact my attractions to other women outside of my marriage, consensually. So when we often get to a space where we accidentally offend or unintentionally cause harm, we're quite often referring to the identity. We're quite often dismissing, using the wrong label, not mirroring the language of the person that we're working with. And at that point, that's where the personal language comes in. That's often where we offend. Gender. This is a very fast crash course. I know there's a lot of information coming at you. So gender is typically broken down into two categories. We have our gender identity, which is up on the screen at the moment, which I'll go through. And on the next slide, we'll talk about gender expression. So give me some examples of genders that you've heard of. What is your gender, if you feel comfortable sharing? Hey, Jax. Do you feel comfortable sharing your gender today?
Sure. So so I use she and they pronouns, which means that sometimes I'm comfortable identifying as a woman, and sometimes I feel like I'm in between the space of woman and fabulous queer person.
I'm also a little bit complicated, for lack of better words. I identify as gender fluid. Every day or periods of months, my gender identity has a tendency to start shifting, which can be a little bit frustrating, makes the wardrobe cost a little bit more because I like to express myself. But yes, my gender identity is gender fluid, and I typically use they, them pronouns as a result. I can assume a few people in this space might identify as a man. And a few people in this space might identify as a woman. And I feel like a few people in space may never have given themselves the opportunity to really sit and do some reflection and be like, what is my gender identity? Has anyone really given me the permission to ask that? So there's gender expression. And so we've all mostly heard of what I would assume is gender roles. Some of those kind of archaic expectations that a woman's place is in the kitchen and a man's place is on the footy field. I completely disagree with those. But gender roles are how society enforces or tries to entrench ideologies of masculinity and femininity. So when a person has a gender identity, they may choose to express that based on how they want to. So they might identify as a man, but want to express a very feminine aspects of their identity and their gender. It doesn't make them any less or more a man. It's just how they choose to express themselves.
And I think when we add disability into the equation, often there can be a lot of pressure on someone with a disability to conform to the gender they were assigned at birth. So if they're presenting as a woman and feeling comfortable with that identity, then they may come under pressure to, you know, wear dresses or skirts or shave their legs or do something to fit more into that assumed role of what a woman should look like. And I think that that's really interesting because it often gets very complex and complicated for people because they may want to be able to feel like they can express their gender and express their femininity and sexuality and be seen for who they are. But then what does that mean if they happen to be queer? Mm. How does that complicate the ways in which they might express or explore their identity and their belonging and connection to that community? So often, I remember when I was younger, and identifying as cisgender, so feeling like I fitted into, or it made sense to me to understand my body as female. I used to wear a lot of short skirts and dresses, and feel like that was really important because often a lot of people would assume that I wouldn't know my gender identity or have a strong sense of a gender identity because I had a disability. So these are some of the kind of complexities that I think we're hoping to tease out, particularly when we're designing the workshop, the two-hour workshop, which we're running face-to-face, and also the online one as well. How does disability complicate this discussion or add a complexity to this discussion? So we just wanted to take a moment to think about why respectful language is important. So it's important because it avoids assumptions, which is really important when you're trying to be respectful and to use the language or pronouns someone is asking you to use. It clarifies if it's relevant, asking someone about their sex, sexuality or gender may not always be important or relevant, just as, you know, people asking about why I'm a wheelchair user in different contexts, depending on why I'm accessing their service, isn't relevant. In terms of best practice language, use language of assigned at birth instead of born. So thinking back to when, you know, a baby's born and we say, we assume that person, that baby is male or female. So thinking back to how they're referred to. Asking who is in your family or what words do you use to describe people in your family. So not assuming that everyone has a mum and a dad. I know for me, I've got a young toddler with my partner, Anne, and that's something really important for me when accessing services, is that people, you know, give me the space to describe who's in my family and describe who's in my life. Transgender is an adjective. So what that means is transgender can be shortened to trans. We don't use the term transgendered. It's not a verb. We do not use the term transgender. It's not a noun. So we can say trans people is kind of the preferred term for the LGBTIQ community. And I think that thinking about language is really key and is something that both the disability community and the queer community continue to have really robust discussions on. And that's something we've found in our co-design group too, is that, you know, people might choose to use really different terms. Like, I like using disabled person sometimes, and sometimes I use person with a disability. Some people use deaf, some people use hard of hearing. Some people use the term queer, some people use lesbian, gay, etc., whatever letter under that acronym they feel fits for them. So really creating a space where people feel like they can tell you who they are and use the language that is important to them, and listening to that language and reflecting that language back is something that we've found to be really important. And also not trying to say you must use this language, like you must always use person with disability, you can't refer to your impairment or whatever that is. So we found that having spaces where we can have those conversations with services and people in our lives is a really key way that we can actually start to create more inclusive environments for LGBTIQ people, but also for people with disabilities.
So quite often we get stuck about how do we even start this conversation. So we're going to have a little bit of a practice at your tables or in the spaces you're currently occupying. We are going to not assume. We're going to introduce yourself to the person either to the left or the right of you. If you feel comfortable, let them know what your pronouns are and maybe a fun little facet about yourself, and then take the time to listen to them. And throughout the rest of the day and how you continue your work, we really hope that you don't assume what pronouns are of other people, but gently ask. So Jax and I will give you a bit of an example. Would you like to start, Jax?
Sure. Hi, I'm Jax and my pronouns are she and they.
Nice to meet you, Jax. My name's Jess and I use they, them and she, her pronouns.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. So please take the next 1 or 2 minutes to partner up and introduce yourselves.
Oh my god, bombshell.
I was like trying to figure out how to tell you. I'm like, I'm gonna tell you about this. I'll tell you at the end because okay. I feel like it's gonna be like a big
thing. Sure, sorry.
Are you okay to do the summary as well, which is number 28?
Yeah, cool. Yeah, that makes sense. So I'm just going to go quickly through intersectionality because I'll just say that's a topic we're going to explore more in the actual longer training.
So I can skip it if you're done.
Yeah?
And just go straight to summary.
Damien said we were going to explore it. So maybe should I? Just aware of time. Also, it's really good to read the slides. I think we'll print them out bigger next time.
I think so too. I kind of realised my bubble as it's going to look. I'm going to start bringing people back to
Okay, so we might come back to the front now.
Thank you, everyone, for participating. I think we're going to try to bring it back to the rest of the workshop.
Cool. So in the interest of time, we're going to push on because we want to get to some group activities, which we'd really love your participation in. We wanted to talk briefly about intersectionality as a key concept that we've come across in the co-design group, and we're going to build into the longer training. So coming back to the front of the room, intersectionality reminds us that everything about us is interlinked. So we're not just a man or a woman or a queer person or a person of colour or a person with a disability. We're multiple different things all at once. And this concept of intersectionality was first coined by Kimberly Crenshaw in the late 1980s to understand how racism and sexism interacted in the lives of women of colour in America. So it's a really useful concept in terms of starting to think through the different experiences you might have because of your gender, because of your sexuality, because of your socioeconomic background, all these kind of things really shape your experiences in life and your access to different spaces and opportunities. So in summary, your sex that you are assigned at birth is not necessarily consistent with the gender that you might identify as. Your gender is not related to your sexuality. They're two separate things. Your sexuality is not related to your sex assigned at birth. Using the correct language and terms is important, including finding out people's names and pronouns. Understanding intersectionality is a really important concept. And again, it's okay to make a mistake. Just apologise for it and try again. So these are some quotes from our co-design group, so from people with lived experience. You don't need to agree with someone's language to mirror it. And then we had lots of discussions about people feeling like when they approach services, either they're great around access and disability, but they're not so good around LGBTIQ issues, or if they're an LGBTIQ service, that they might be really good about thinking through those things, but really terrible at access. So really trying to think about how we can make services really supportive and inclusive of people. So now we're going to get you to do some small group work. You should each have a scenario at your table, and we want you to talk about it as a group and think about how you might respond or support that person.
So on your table, there should be an A3 size paper with a scenario. Please take the time to read through the scenario. And for the next 15 minutes, please work within your group to address the question. It sounds like there is some amazing conversations happening, but we need to start slowly bringing it back to the centre.
And I forgot to say to our poor people that have been sitting there online going, what's happening, if you'd scrolled forward, we could have had the scenarios up for them. Oh, well, sorry, online people.
So which group? I don't think everyone got a different scenario, but did anyone have scenario number one? It should tell you at the top of your A3 piece of paper. did a particular table grab scenario one? If not, we'll move on to... Yeah, oh, at the back. Did someone at the table want to really quickly read out just the scenario and maybe mention one or two key points that you thought of?
I just noticed a short straw come my way. So we had scenario one, misgendering client. You're in a meeting with another person and your client, and this person is consistently misgendering your client. They know your client's real pronouns and gender, but are not using them. Your client is visibly uncomfortable and becoming more distressed as this continues. Before the meeting, you asked your client whether or not you should say something if this happened, and they said yes. So there was five scenarios. Pick as many or as few correct answers. So and the scenarios were...
In the interest of time, do you just want to tell us which ones you went with, which ones you picked?
We had a long convo. We certainly weren't... I don't think we were looking at number five, which is to yell at them. we might want to do that inwardly. We just think that it's a work scenario. It's about professional conduct.
Yep. Right.
We'll do that internally, but not externally. We felt it's imperative, as we've had the conversation with the client as well, that we should call them out on this and not let it slide to the keeper. So we've probably looked at between numbers two and four, which is wait for them to do it again and then correct them. But in saying that, the end of two is correct them once. We'd want to correct them more than once. We also had a long discussion about should we correct them every time or every couple of times.
Yeah, yeah.
But we absolutely want to correct. We don't want it to go unnoticed.
Okay, fabulous. Yeah, so this is one of the ones we're going to build into the online space. So it'll come up and then you'll click on it and it'll say that answer's correct or you could do better. On our cheat sheet, the correct ones are number three, which is to keep correcting them, and then also number four as well. Does that make sense?
Who had scenario number two, which was misgendering by services?
No?
No? What about scenario number three? It should say at the very top. Oh, it looks like the table down at the front. Is someone at your table happy to quickly read out the scenario and just give us your feedback?
So our scenario was you work at a disability advocacy organisation. Part of your job is to hold regular meetings of an advisory group of disabled people. One of the advisory group members is trans. Other group members frequently misgender them and make transphobic comments. And then there are five different kind of responses that we discussed. The ones we kind of focused on were around kind of training and also like having a policy in place so that people are all... training kind of underpins people's responses, and that having that in place first would be like really helpful before looking at how you could expand the group to make sure that trans people were included and felt safe.
Great. So in terms of the answers in our cheat sheet here, we were saying number one, so seek out more trans people to be part of the advisory group so that person doesn't feel alone, so they feel like they've got someone who shares their experience and is there with them. Number three, which is to pay a disabled trans activist to run mandatory training so people are getting some training around stuff. And number five, which is about the policies, which is a really great point as well. Thank you.
Cheers. And who had scenario number four?
we didn't come up with any solution. We were just coming up when we were told we were finished. We decided that basically we decided that to complain to advocacy organizations.
And did you have anything else you wanted to add from your group onto that?
Greg, also, if it's okay, you said that you could confront the person directly and talk about that everyone has a right to sexual identity and gender identity. We also had making a complaint to the person's manager and connecting John with a self-advocacy group if he was keen so he could speak up for himself.
Mm-hmm.
Any others?
And Rainbow writes... self-advocacy might be a great one in this instance because it's run by LGBTI people with disabilities. So connecting him into community as well as to connecting him into advocates. Yep, great.
And who had scenario 5, which was carer choosing clothing? This table over here. Could you please read out and give us some examples?
Yes. So our scenario was Fatima is living with intellectual disabilities and is getting ready to go to a family wedding. Fatima usually wears gender-neutral clothing. When you arrive to visit her, you find she is very distressed because her carer is dressing her in a very frilly dress. The carer says, I know she doesn't want to wear it, but it's just for the photos. The family want her in a dress and she won't really know where she is anyway. What do you do? So unlike some of the other scenarios, we did not have multiple choice.
Yeah, sorry.
So we talked about it and agreed initially that we would separate Fatima from her carer and ask her specifically how she's feeling.
Cool.
And try and grasp her understanding of what's going on and whether or not she wants to change.
Right.
Or... wants to compromise and wear a dress in a photo and then not.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we thought it was not appropriate to assume what she does and doesn't know.
Great.
I think that's a fantastic response. Thank you. And then we have scenario 6, which I think is the trickiest, personally, out of all the... so sorry, group number 6 at the back.
So we had scenario 6, lack of services in rural areas. It reads, your client is a transgender woman with a chronic illness and a complex psychosocial disability. She is unable to access medical care as the closest medical clinic that understands the medication and care she requires as a trans woman is an hour away. She does not drive and is unable to take public transport. This has left her ill, socially isolated, and she is unable to cope with symptoms of her illness in public. Her symptoms would be treatable if she could access a trained medical professional. Ararat only has one doctor that accepts bulk billing, which is important when you're on a disability support pension. However, the doctor is male and your client is not comfortable visiting him. So none of us work rurally.
Okay.
We do have one advocate. But we had a few kind of ideas and we thought it might be a situation where you have to... try a number of options and kind of see what works. We talked about potentially finding a doctor in Ararat who is a woman and would bulk bill this client mm-hmm. because of they're on a disability support pension, even if they don't usually do that. We also talked about a teleconference or Skype kind of setup with the doctor who's further away, even if that was... as often as possible. And we also spoke about, talking to the doctors and seeing what they thought too. So, yeah. Is that everything? Yeah?
Great suggestion.
Oh, and transport. A transport's a nightmare, but if you could work it out, that would be good.
Yeah, cool. If you could get transport funding in the NDIS plan or something, yeah. Great, thank you so much. And sorry to those last two groups that didn't have the multiple choice answers. We hadn't got that far in building the scenario, so you just helped us work out what some of those might be. Cool.
So what we're going to move on to next is we're going to show you a short video of people who are LGBTQIA+ with lived experiences as people with disabilities talking to you about their feelings, their perspectives, and their thoughts on some Queer 101. So please take it away, technician.
My name is Liam. I identify as a genderqueer transmasculine person.
My name is Erin Kian. My pronouns are he, him. I am a queer, disabled trans man, and I make podcasts. I'm here today to help you understand a little bit more about LGBTIQA+ identities and experiences.
I'm here today to answer some important questions, mostly around Queer 101 and what it means to be queer and disabled at the same time.
So, some commonalities between being disabled and being LGBTIQA+ is that they're both umbrella terms. These terms cover a lot of different things underneath them.
There's a lot of internal love and acceptance and a lot of outside stigma for both of those things.
Both categories are also people who are discriminated against in society, and both things are often pathologized by the medical industry, even in situations where that pathology is not necessary.
What does sexuality mean to you?
So sexuality or orientation is a way of categorizing how people experience their attractions to other people.
Things like who you're attracted to and the sort of things about those people that you may be attracted to as well. But for example, your sexuality, if you are straight and you're a man, means that you're probably attracted to women. I identify as a queer person, and what I like about that is that I don't need to pinpoint exactly what that means to other people. I can just be attracted to who I'm attracted to.
In my case, I identify as bisexual, which means that I'm capable of being attracted to people regardless of what their gender is.
The way that those things are different can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people.
You're going to hear the words gender and sex a lot in the other training that you'll be receiving as part of this program. And the difference between those things is that gender is how a person identifies, and sex is a way that we categorize physical bodies.
For example, your sex is, generally speaking, the thing that was assigned to you when the doctor pulled you out, basically. It's mostly around the physical parts of you, whereas gender is more about the way that you know and feel that you are.
So in terms of gender and sex, using myself as an example, when I was born, I was assigned female, and my body has been categorized as female. However, over my life, that did not feel to me like a correct thing about myself. Like most people, I think we all evolve as people as we grow. And in my case, my gender also evolved in a different way from how my sex was categorized. Now, just because I was assigned female, that doesn't necessarily mean that my body is female. Especially at this point, when I have taken part in medical transition, the phrase of sex and that kind of categorization starts to get a lot more complicated when you're talking about people like me. A lot of people think that being trans is a mental illness. Now, a lot of trans people, including myself, do have mental illness, but we are not trans because we are mentally ill. The mental illness and being trans are separate things that just happen to be taking place in the same person.
It's a very personal thing for each individual person. and it implies that there may be some stigma around that, or there may be something wrong, or there may be something fixable about being gender diverse, queer, or intersex. And it's who I am. I'm the only one who has a right to define my sexuality or my gender or anything around that. I'm the only one who would actually know what it is. And so when people tell me that I can't possibly be that, or that it means something that they're interpreting, it's not only incorrect, but it tells me that you're not seeing me in the way that I know that I am.
Now, when people think that being gender diverse, queer, or intersex is a disability, that's removing an entire part of a person and dehumanizing them based on that. You're pathologizing something that is not necessarily a pathology.
What do you think it's important for service providers to
It's important for service providers to be informed about LGBTQIA+ identities and issues, because we're going to be your clients. And if we're your clients, it's your job to have enough information to help us in a meaningful way.
When a service provider gets
things right, it feels so good. It feels like I am being treated equally. It feels like things are normal. It feels like the way that things should be all the time. It's not so much a feeling as a relaxing of, oh, I'm being cared for just like anyone else.
When a service provider gets it right, that builds a much stronger trust between the client and the service. And that trust makes it much more possible to get the client's needs met correctly. Some examples of when a service provider gets it right and are actually caring for their client's needs in a helpful way are things like having a chosen name and pronouns fields on their forms, or having gender neutral and accessible bathrooms at their practice. It's fine to ask them questions, but if there's something you don't know anything about, I recommend that you find someone outside of your relationship with your client to help you find that information.
You're gonna get it wrong, and that's okay. The fact is, you've gotta start learning somewhere, you've gotta try. I guess the main advice I would give is, if you are trying and you're still offending someone, try again, because for you, you may have made a mistake once. For them, they may have heard that same mistake 10 times that day. So it can be a bit frustrating for them.
So thank you for watching that. Just a note on access, we are going to get the questions which popped up audio described and put in the final version. So now we might take a couple of minutes, and I know surveys can be a bit boring, but it's really important for this little program to continue and to hopefully get more funding. And also for us to know how you honestly found this very quick 1 hour presentation and what you might like to see included in the future training. So if you could take a moment to fill out that form. If that form isn't accessible to you and you would like us to send you a digital copy, we can do that as well. Just put your hand up and we'll come and grab your email address and send that across.
We also have forms printed out on larger font as well. They should be available on the tables. So please spend the next 5 minutes just quickly filling out that one page form. Would really appreciate it.
Can we just go through to our contact details on that? And that's just our contact emails on the screen too. So please feel free to get in touch. You'll definitely hear from us again. And we really welcome you to attend the face-to-face training on the 12th of May, and also to do the online module and to share that around when it comes out next month as well.
And if you or your organisation or if your community is interested in taking some training yourselves, when we've developed the 4-hour training module, or if you'd like us to do the in-person training, please send us an email and we can see what we can organise together.
thank you very much, Jackson, Jess. That was really great. I'm really, really, really looking forward to seeing the online training module. It looked really exciting project. We've really enjoyed this process very much. And thank you very much. And please make sure you fill in the surveys, because your feedback is really important in informing this kind of work. Because if we don't hear from you, we can't make sure that the information we give you is relevant to your work. So it's really important. We'll take a short break now, and if you can be back at 2:30, we'll move on to the next presentation. Thank you very much.